me introduce myself again. Fred Kramer. I've been here a couple of weeks, and I'm coming really as a, I'm not a theologian and I'm not a minister, so I'm kind of a part of a secular faculty in a sense. And even in this role that I'm talking about today, I'm talking about the whole issue of dehumanization and how we become dehumanized in society. I'm really not an expert in that, in terms of I'm no great psychologist or sociologist, but I speak primarily from my interest in, as 25 years in higher education, I've been an administrator, primarily a dean of students. And I guess I was particularly influenced by the late 60s and 70s when the campuses were so filled with a kind of a period of alienation, and that students and other people in society were so alienated against the institutions, whether it be college, the church, the government, that they begin to ask serious questions about basic values. That is, they lost their, the institutions lost their sense of credibility. They were no longer seen as moral, that the ideals that society had were so far from practice that they began to call into question the very society. And of course, we were all caught up in the argument over the war, but that was just another kind of example of how society had kind of put blinders on and allowed things to happen in the name of a just war or whatever the rationalization, that we begin to then question as we begin to examine it more clearly. So this whole question of how we as society give sanctions for social destructiveness, how we allow this to happen, is a, something that I've been particularly interested in. And so I was interested in a book called Sanctions for Evil. It's by Sanford and Comstock, and they really kind of dissect the whole issue of how society allows others to be socially destructive in their name, how we as society give permission to others to be socially destructive. And so we're, the dramatic examples, obviously, of course, we think of, first of all, is the German, the Nazis' treatment of the Jews, and how that whole society somehow put blinders on what was happening and allowed Hitler to begin a wholesale extermination. And we have these examples in society today where many governments are engaged in torture, and some people evidently who are doing this torture somehow believe that they have sanctions from authorities. We've had examples in terms of when the police get out of hand, in terms of police brutality. We have examples in terms of mob violence, when a mob gets out of hand, when there's looting, when somehow the mob, or you as a member of a mob, think that you somehow have license and permission to do things that you otherwise wouldn't do because somehow the group has given you that kind of a sanction. First of all, in terms of the concept of evil as the authors spell it out, they're really talking about evil as in terms of a separateness of man from man, a separateness of man from environment, or, and we would call a separateness of man from God, but they also terms of man, the separateness of man from one's own sense of personality, that you separate your own ego from the other parts of your personality. And so it's, evil is seen as an inability or an unwillingness to overcome separation, that we refuse to see our whole life and the world as a whole process, that we separate ourselves the process. And I think one way that we ignore the wholeness of society, the fact that we are one family, is when we allow ourselves to be dehumanized. And when that happens when we begin to think of others in terms that are less than human, when we begin to develop the we, they point of view, when we see a group and we begin to label them. And we have, you know, plenty of examples of that in terms of our own history. As I say, the Germans began to think that way about the Jewish people. We certainly in our early history began to think of the Indians, the Native Americans, in those terms. And our whole history of racism, obviously. And I think that we began to think that way, some of us, in terms of the Vietnamese and allowing things to happen over there that gave us permission to treat people to in a way that was less than human. And a couple of the chapters go into some detail in trying to analyze the My Lai massacre. And I think the point that some of the psychologists who've tried to study what happened to the men involved in that was that at some point they had internalized their belief that somehow even the women and children were the enemy, that at the time that they pulled the trigger they were not somehow being, they just hadn't lost their head, so to speak, but they had somehow convinced themselves that they were part of the enemy, they were less than human, and they allowed themselves to be caught up in a massacre mentality. And these were men who could have been our relatives, our brothers and sons, who somehow, in terms of the whole atmosphere and the things that they were caught up in, began to think of these people as less than human. That's an extreme example, but I think it's a dramatic one. Now, fortunately, we're not in any war today, and I think we begin to think, well, that's past history. But I guess I'm still concerned about the issue is what are the signs in today's society that may indicate that we still are prone to dehumanizing other people? Just one more word about dehumanizing before I begin to get more practical in terms of what's happening today. The two sides of dehumanization. One side is what happens to the victims when you begin to think of people as less than human and treat them that way. They become dehumanized too. And there are, I don't know if some of you heard John the other day talking about when he was in Washington, and one of the little black boys was having, the school was having some new books developed, and before they were all the books, the reading books were the C. Jane run and C. Dick run, and they were all white, yellow-haired children. When they changed the books, this little boy said, "I don't want to use these new books." The new books had more pictures of black kids and more interracial. And he said about a black little boy, "He's dumb." That as a black child, he had already been dehumanized. He began to think that all black children were dumb. And I think that's a kind of a dramatic example of what happens to the victim when we become, when we dehumanize them. They begin to accept the status that they are somehow less than human. And obviously that was part of the breakthrough in terms of what the black community was trying to say to each other when they said black is beautiful. They were trying to develop a kind of a self-image that was positive. So there's that side. Dehumanization really does dehumanize other people in terms of their own image. It also dehumanizes the person who becomes involved in it. That is, when you begin to think of a person as somehow less than human, when you begin to reduce them, somehow denigrate their fullness as a person, that in a sense robs you, that you begin to then be less than a full person yourself, that you begin to lose your sense of being able to relate to people fully, that you become a part, that it does damage and violence to your own personality, that when you allow other people to practice, or when you perpetuate some social destructiveness or dehumanization to others, you become a victim too. Well, I'm not going to go into any more theory. I'm not trying to lay out the whole psychological and sociological background of that process of dehumanization. I guess I'm concerned about the danger signals, and maybe I really like to talk about what you feel maybe are some of the danger signals in society today. And I was trying to jot them down. Then I'd like to look at, once we got some of the danger signals, talk a little bit about what are some of the defenses that we as individuals or societies have against the subtle and not so subtle ways that we're dehumanized. We talked about this earlier, and people have brought out some examples today in terms of where we're dehumanizing people, and one of the dramatic examples maybe is in terms of how we treat older people, that we begin to think of them as less than human, not needing the same kind of love and care. Certainly our prison system is dehumanizing, even though we try not to do it, it is by definition almost that. I'm not talking so much about particular examples as I'm talking about a frame of mind. And maybe these kind of statements that you hear people say ring some bells. The things that I think perhaps are danger signals, when we begin to say that they are so immersed in a network, a hopeless kind of network of violence and muggings and prostitution, that it's almost hopeless, that the only remedy is more police. Or we say that they are old and they are better off in a nursing home where they can be taken care of without being a burden to anyone. Or when we say they are getting greedy, all they want is more money, they really don't care about children or they don't care about society. We could be talking about teachers or policemen when they go on strike. We are saying those people are deviants from society and are therefore dangerous and don't deserve the full rights of other citizens. Perhaps some of that's creeping in when we talk about homosexuals or the gay community. And also, I think whenever we are despairing, whenever we have fear, when we fear things, or when we're in despair, or when we are in grave uncertainty, we begin to be prone to be dehumanizing because we're so concerned about our own welfare that we begin to ignore and lose concern for others. Perhaps even we're in danger of being dehumanized when we begin to talk about, I've been taxed enough, they will just have to manage with less, talking about people who are on welfare or whatever, whoever they are. And then perhaps another danger signal, there's no sense in giving any more money to government or that institution because I don't have any say about how it's spent, and that organization is corrupt or foolish and are wasting our money. And when we say, I don't agree, but everybody else seems to think it's the right thing to do, And who am I to question this whole sense of personal helplessness? And another thing which I think is perhaps very pervasive, and certainly the whole message of culture shock, is I can't comprehend what is going on. Change is too fast. Things are going along at such a rate that it's just beyond my power to comprehend it, and so I'm not even going to try anymore. Another thing that we sometimes hear some people say is the population explosion is impossible. Some of them will just probably have to starve. And we look at the worldwide situation, that kind of a lifeboat mentality that says that we somehow have to take care of our own society, and the population problem is out of control and there's nothing we can do about it. Well, I just threw those out as possible danger signals that may indicate that we as individuals or society are beginning to fall into some areas of dehumanization. I guess I'd just like to stop right now and just give us a chance to react to those, and agree, disagree, or have other examples.
Well, Fred, you mentioned the tax, the tax revolt. Proposition 13 began in California, kind of sweeps the country. It seems that that's a distancing between my dollars and what they do for somebody else. And dehumanization is actually just that, distancing myself from someone else. If we would characterize what those dollars do, it might be much more difficult to engage in such a groundswell tax revolt. But if you can keep the distance there, and I believe a dehumanizer wants to, does not want to personalize what that might mean, he therefore can then vote the way he feels. Same way in school levies. In the state of Washington, we've had school levies for so long, and every time there was a threat that the school levy wasn't going to pass, immediately the administration would try to personalize by trying to take away some personal things, like sports and music. And then when it didn't pass, they got them anyway. And so there was there was not much credibility to that. So sometimes there was a forced humanization of the issue, and when you have found that that's not credible, then you don't believe that either. Mm-hmm. So there's, I think both sides to that, that to personify an issue or to make it personal is all right if there's some credibility to it. But if it's impossible to do, then there has to be a better method of humanizing an issue.
Yes, certainly the tax issue is a controversial one, and you can certainly make good cases that there are times when taxes do need to be cut, and there are excesses. And I think that your example is a good one. That people have lost even credibility in anybody's justification. That there's a kind of a, well, that's perhaps related partly to the culture shock, is that the institutions have gotten so large and we feel so remote from them that we just kind of give up and we don't try to understand. We label everybody's rationalization as just another kind of explanation. We don't try to sort it out for ourselves.
We got a reaction, something like that, too, in the East, from some informed people who had come from California. And they said that there was, when they started to cut out things like adult education and these services and everything, and how everybody was going to suffer, that was the propaganda. They said there's plenty of money for everything. That's just a scare tactic.
Mm-hmm. So it's hard to sort that out. But I guess what I'm talking about is not so much as where the proper tax level is, as what the motives behind people are. When you begin to begin to translate that into somehow into that people have too much. And I think the welfare issue is one. And again, welfare is a very complex problem, but I think when we begin to think that somehow we that people just have to manage without our help, that may be an indication of looking at things in a dehumanizing way. Any other examples from your own experience or that you think are areas that you're concerned about in terms of our looking at people as less than human?
Maybe a slight indication of that comes from where we come from in the Bay Area, where there are so many people that we feel like when we walk into a restaurant or we walk places, and if we don't know them, if they're not a part of our congregation or our church, we just automatically assume that we would not be interested in conversing with them, nor they in us. When we got to Chelan, you know, and somebody, we walked in the store and somebody said, "Who are you and where are you from and what are you doing?" And we just couldn't believe that. Someone would do that. And I think that there's maybe one of the reasons we said that we wanted some time Poland too is to get in touch again with all kinds of people and that feeling of that we don't count a whole lot, nor does somebody else when we meet so many people every day in a big city.
When you say you're from the Bay Area, what does that mean? I mean, is it San Francisco Bay or?
Yes.
Like in the East, people say, "We're from the city," which always means New York City.
When you're out on the coast, the Bay, then.
Yeah.
Well, that's certainly one result of our mass society and just sheer numbers. Is that we begin to accept the role that we can't relate to everybody. We can't be, at least we say, we can't really say hello and be friendly with everybody all the time, and so we build up our own kind of shell. And what we talking before too in terms of some occupations require you're building up more defenses than others. If you're perhaps a policeman or a doctor and you're dealing with violence or injury all the time, or a nurse, you have to develop some kind of defenses. So you can't be, as I say, bleeding all the time for everybody's hurt. That doesn't mean that those people become immune to it or heartless. Obviously they don't. There are many people who were very compassionate in those occupations. And yet there's so much of it that you have to protect yourself. Well, I guess the danger that, and it's the danger of any kind of occupation or it's the danger of society, is that we fail to realize that what we are doing to ourselves is we are somehow developing social distance. And I guess we could talk about one of the defenses is maybe being continually reminding ourselves what is happening to us, that this is the tendency, the thing, one of the tensions in today's life that we always have to be concerned about and fighting. It's too easy to fall into a pattern. And I suspect that that's one of the problems in terms of television and getting used to violence, is that and during the war, we saw so much of it, and we see so much of it now on television. In terms of all the violent things that are happening in the world are portrayed to us every night, and so we just begin to accept the fact that this is the way the world is, and there's not much we can do about it.
I was just thinking, sometimes I go through a little struggle in the morning. on the daughter's theory. She's rather an extroverted person, and she goes up to strangers and starts talking. And I've wondered, you know, I want her to feel positive about other people. And, but then there's this struggle. Perhaps, you know, there are some dangers in that too, especially for a child. You know, where do you draw the line and how do you know where, you know, to draw the line?
That's a tough question.
It seems like that sort of takes care of itself. I think, you know, as she gets into school and whatnot, she'll withdraw. I mean, might.
It is difficult. I can see the dramatic change for you from moving from a mass society up to Holden, where it takes a while, even for people who get here, to begin to let their defenses down and begin to accept people, and that this really is a community, and this is a really the gift of it, of the community in a sense. And yet, when you move back into a society that doesn't have that kind of openness and acceptance, it's going to be a shock, I'm sure.
It just seems that the style of American society in the larger and larger cities and bigger companies and that sort of thing, just the whole thing becomes self-perpetuating, because, you know, if you're in a factory where there's thousands of people, there's not really much incentive to try and get to know people, because everyone else there, well, a lot of the people seem to be kind of afraid, and they don't really want to talk. Not that they don't want to talk, but they're just afraid to get to know someone else, because they don't know what that person wants from them or something. And so then, if you're attempting, you know, to communicate with other people, and one person rejects you, and then another person rejects you, then you become just how they are. You're afraid to start talking to other people because nothing comes back to you. You know, they don't respond to you, so then you start trying yourself, and it kind of, then you become just the same as everyone else, and everyone's the same, kind of hard.
Yeah, I was thinking the other day when John was talking and laying out the way that we relate to society today, and then moving into the whole area of witnessing, how we witness. We can be so positive when we're here together, because we get strength from each other, and we can all agree that we must witness, and our life is a witness too. And yet, and this I think is one of the real challenges, that there are so many forces that are depersonalizing us, as you're talking about, in fact, that in a sense are dehumanizing us, that we also, I think, need to talk a little bit more directly, and this is why the issue is interesting to me, is what we can do to begin to build defenses against dehumanization. How do we as individuals act and react in this kind of a world and institution? Maybe we can move into some of those defenses a little bit. I kind of broke this into two areas. One, in terms of what we as individuals might do, and what we as individuals then in institutions might do. Obviously, the message of Holden and the message of Christ is that we are all one people, and we're God's creation, and if we somehow need to be remind ourselves of that and pray and get strength from each other, that is obviously the Christian's best defense, is that we are all one people. We all are God's creation. The other thing, as I mentioned before, is that when we begin to keep reminding ourselves when other people are dehumanized, that we also are being dehumanized, that if we don't lose sight of that, that when we allow a society to put old people in institutions and then we forget about them, that we become party to that kind of a dehumanization. We've given sanction for that kind of an approach. And the other thing I think is that we accept the fact that in order to survive in society, and I think we have to harden ourselves, we have to develop defense mechanisms, but we have to realize that that is, again, dangerous, and we have to, if we raise those to a consciousness and begin to say, I have to be careful, I'm getting so used to what all the violence and all the trouble that I'm not thinking about it. I'm closing myself out. The other thing I think we can do is begin to look at news, be critical observers of what kind of messages we're getting in the newspapers, and realize how that's influencing us. The other, I think, one way in terms of a way to feel like you're not helpless victim is if you can begin to gain some knowledge of an issue or a problem. That when you begin to know something and understand more about a problem, whether it's the penal institutions or welfare or anything, the neighborhood, then you begin to see it's complex, it's difficult, but there are some solutions, and you begin to then perhaps gain a little strength and self-confidence. If you don't know anything about anything, it's very easy for you to let everybody else make decisions for you. So I think we need that knowledge in itself is a defense. Now, it's not a sure defense, because certainly there are a lot of intelligent people who know a lot about problems who sometimes put blinders on and aren't open, and they take one point of view. And perhaps an example of that was, and there's something here they talk about called groupthink, where you're in an institution and everybody thinks the same. And so instead of raising questions and the knowledge being liberating, knowledge becomes kind of enslaving. And one of the interesting chapter in terms of the advisors around President Johnson, in terms of the people who had convinced themselves that the war in Vietnam was necessary and had to be pursued the way it was, they somehow, you know, all of these very bright, intelligent people had somehow begun to look at things all the same way, and there weren't the people in that circle that were beginning to ask questions, the critics. And so, while knowledge of an issue is important defense, it's not necessarily a foolproof one.
I was just thinking, I don't mean to disagree with you.
No, but
I think there's this is an incomplete disagreement, but I think there's also a thing where if you don't know something, it's easier to make an opinion. My husband and I, we've lived on an Indian reservation and worked with the Indian church for 3 years now. And I think I was more, I had the solutions more before than I do now. I'm more confused than ever about the answer to the whole Indian problem.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm glad you brought that out, because obviously there isn't an easy solution out there, and once you know the problem, it'll unfold. But I think, I guess my reply to that is that I think we all go through those cycles, that that we learn something about the problem, we get into it, we realize that it's so complex that we also can become so discouraged because it's so complex that we don't know what to do. And then we get kind of paralyzed in action. But I suspect that even though all of us have those feelings once in a while, you still have got some values and beliefs, and even though you're unclear, you're moving ahead with some kind of basic premises. And so we move beyond that to some kind of commitment to help try to do what we can to solve the problem. At least we're wrestling with it. We're not giving up. And that seems to me an important part of not being dehumanized, is not let the system say there's nothing that can be done. Even though you're struggling and you feel like it's hopeless. I think a good illustration. Okay, one of the things that we certainly need, and this is, it seems to me, what a congregation can do, and that is we need to strengthen each other, to strengthen our own values. We have to get nurture and reinforcement from each other to hold on to our values, to not somehow be discouraged and let the overpowering kind of hopelessness of some of these situations discourage us. We have to be it's very hard to be alone and stand up for your values if you're the only person in 100, and you soon begin to doubt yourself, and you have to have a very strong faith. And certainly the history of the Christian church is that fortunately there were so many people that did have that faith, that became martyrs, that became, that spent endless years in prison and so forth, but somehow maintained it. That requires certainly the grace of God and a great gift to be able to do that alone. But we're more fortunate, I think, in today's society, as we do have people who will reinforce us. But I think we need to use that. The other thing, I think, is also one of the points that they make in terms of ways of looking at thinking of things. And if Jack Kling were here, he would, I think, say particularly, we don't look at things enough through the eyes of the artist or the creative person, that we have to develop our sense of creative imagination, that we, if we're creative and we have more of a sense of awe and wonder, and we develop our facilities for a rich imagination, that then we're less prone to fall into these patterns of thinking of things in purely rational terms. And we allow our own kind of our humanity, our gut feelings of love and concern and awe to come through. They don't get layered over with all the rationalizations that we develop for society. And so that cultivating a sense of creative imagination is perhaps one way to protect ourselves, because then we always look at things differently. Somebody poses a problem, or they say, make a statement, and we begin to kind of to look at it a little differently. And that is perhaps and certainly when John was talking about the fact that the church is counterculture in so many senses today, maybe we have to be more of that than we realize. Counterculture in the sense that we begin to, if we look at things through the eyes of a Christian, that's looking at things in a radical different way today, because that's not the way everyone else looks at things. In terms of an organization, how do you sense, recover your sense of identity in a large organization? Some of the things that seem to emerge from that book is the fact that if you're part of an organization that's beginning to do things that you feel somehow are not right, one of the techniques, again, this is a technique, is you begin to call attention to what the overall purpose and value system that that organization or institution was originally dedicated to. So that one of the things that you can do, you appeal to authority in terms of saying, no, you know, why did we as a company get started? What's our purpose? Originally, it was to serve the people in this community, or it was to develop the best kind of product we could. I mean, what is the purpose? It's a little harder in terms of a profit-making organization to use that kind of. But there are many organizations that you're part of that you can begin at least to help to question with other people, what is our ultimate purpose? What are we doing this for? And that's one. And you find that people begin to look at that and they say, well, you know, that we really have kind of strayed from our purpose. Obviously, the other way is just to begin to not be fearful about voicing your doubts and concerns in thoughtful manner to others in terms of what's happening. Because there may be other people who have the also, doubts, but they are afraid to say anything. You may find that there are more people who are raising questions and thinking about things in a different way. And so that again is one way. I think you also have to be conscious of the fact that when we're part of an organization, whether we want it or not, there's a subtle influence that we're beginning to develop a kind of an organizational mentality. We're beginning to think like everybody else in the organization, and that there gets to be a point of view. And if we're aware of that danger tendency in ourselves and in an organization, perhaps we can find ways to build some defenses. And I think we always have to keep reminding ourselves that there are some higher laws of morality than just what even our country says sometimes. The philosophy of my country, right or wrong, can lead us into some problems that we need to realize that there are some higher laws of morality and justice. I think basically when it comes down to a cliche, but I think that one I find helpful is, what are we going to become part of the family of man, or become part of the uncaring crowd? We have to see that kind of dichotomy, and it's so easy to become part of the uncaring crowd rather than the family of man. Maybe some of the other of you have some ideas or in terms of some kind of defenses that you think are important, that you found helpful, or you think that might be utilized by people to try to help protect them from being powerless or helpless or being dehumanized.
I was thinking of this idea of developing a gift. I suppose that may seem a little bit far off, but I was thinking of one particular Indian cell that we knew just the summer that we had moved down to the reservation. There was this one fellow who discovered that he could carve. And he carved, you know, in wood and stone. And his themes were kind of themes that he had on his mind, were these things that bothered him. He felt powerless. But somehow in his carving, he kind of shared some of these feelings. And my husband helped to provide him opportunities with white people and the church to show some of these. And I think these carvings conveyed more than what he ever could have spoken. And it was a development, you know, of his gift, but yet expressing something. And I think somehow or other this helped him to feel better about himself and not quite so powerful.
helping people to find some ways to express their individuality and their concerns. It's a struggle for, basically, for individuality in a mass society is part of the challenge. One of the other ways that we can go too far on that, I suppose, is a tendency is that we become so much concerned with our own individual development that we turn our back on society, and that idea of retreating is certainly appealing. Sometimes you're in a community where the problem seems so overwhelming that you'd really like to retreat.
I picked up a little book by Walter Lippmann over here in the library and looked at it a while ago, called Public Philosophy. Mm-hmm. If any of you read that, I'd highly recommend that book. It answers some of the questions.
What was one of the things that he was saying?
Well, our daily lives, such that it has to benefit more than just us. It has to include the public. Mm-hmm. And the whole society. It doesn't do any good that I become any millionaire if I don't take someone else along.
Sense of responsibility for others. Do you feel generally optimistic or pessimistic about society today in terms of this question of dehumanization? Do you think we're making progress or slipping backward?
We're at least stalling.
Well, it seems like with this trend of the younger people to get closer to the earth, sort of, and back to nature, might be somewhat of a trend.
Yeah, I think this is one of the, in terms of one of the definitions of these authors, in terms of evilness as a separating man from his environment. I think that there are certainly some counter feeling forces today that are overcoming, and as you indicated, more and more people are trying to return to the earth and gain the appreciation. And then I suppose the whole concern for pollution and what we're doing to our environment is a positive sign in terms of we're looking at least at the environment as a whole, at the creation as a whole. Well, I'd recommend this book to you if you're interested in looking at this in a little bit more detail. It's really a compilation of variety of authors, but they examine all kinds of facets of how society, how we do give permission to each other to perpetuate this social destructiveness, and then we turn our backs and don't realize, you know, what happened or why it did happen. Well, if there's no further comments, I think we can end right now. Appreciate your coming and hope that giving you something to think about.